Commerce and Consumer Protection Committee will come to order. It's Thursday, March 8th, 2007, and we're going to begin with Senate File 504. Senator Torres-Ray, welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. This is my first time before your committee, and I really appreciate this opportunity. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I am very happy to be here before you to present a bill that has been before this committee before. You've been working on it for some time, and finally we are now at a point where we have a lot of support from health insurance plans and from the community, and so we're very pleased to come to a time and a place where we can say that most of us agree that this needs to be done. So I'm very pleased to report that to the committee. And with me, I have some people that will be testifying, some parents, and I will. I have several people who wish to testify before the committee. So I will ask you, Madam Chair, to let me know how much you want to hear from the different parents. But they are here to provide testimony and also to answer questions.
And Senator Torres-Ray, anybody who comes here in the, through the snow, on the ice, with small children, deserves to be heard if
Absolutely.
They wish to speak. So.
Thank you.
I welcome anyone who would like to testify. I mean, we aren't going to take all afternoon, of course, but that, and I don't think they want to either.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is, I'm presenting Senate File 504, but before I go there, I have a delete all amendment that I would like to ask a member of the committee to please move on my behalf.
Senator Prettner-Solon, would you move the A1 amendment? She does. The A1 amendment. To put the bill in the shape the author would like. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails, and we've adopted the delete everything amendment. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I also have an additional amendment that I – no, this is it. Thank you. We've been working on this for a while, so I want to make sure that this is in the shape that we need it. Madam Chair and members of the committee, the bill that is before you is intended to provide coverage for elemental formula, which is also called amino acid formula, for patients who are unable to eat any food, and that includes breast milk. All of the patients that will be covered under this plan are children under the age of 5. And some of them are here today, and their parents are here to answer to some of the questions you may have. Madam Chair and members of the committee, the reason the parents are here and they came to us for our support is because they were not able in the past to work with their health plans to get cover for to cover this formula. And so... because of current regulations, health insurance companies cannot cover this formula today, and they can only cover this formula if it is administered through a gastronasal tube. And some of the parents will talk to you about this, and some of you know. And I have Dr. Alan Stillman, who will be talking about this condition and will offer the expertise that you need in order to make a decision today. What I need to tell you is that this particular issue poses a tremendous financial burden to these families. Some of these families are having to pay between $10,000 to $20,000 a year in order to feed their kids. And we believe that we need to help these families. As I said at the beginning, I am happy to report to this committee that we have been having conversations with the health plans in Minnesota, and they believe that this is an issue that they would like to support. And if you have any questions related to, the mandate for health insurance companies, we will be happy to respond to those questions. So I am going to ask Dr. Stillman to please present to you this issue and to talk about the conditions of these children so that if you have any questions, he will be able to respond.
Dr. Stillman, welcome to our committee.
Thank you, and good afternoon, Madam Chairperson and committee. I thank you for allowing me to testify on this important issue this afternoon. In a sentence, the solution to the problem we're addressing today is the correct solution. It's elemental. It's elementary. Certain severe medical conditions require the presentation of the elementary broken down amino acid based blocks of protein to the patient. For some patients, it's because they react immunologically to the whole protein or parts thereof. In others, it's to assist in the digestive process. There is a handout which addresses the further clarification of these diseases, and in the language, the diseases that that from which patients suffer have been itemized. But it's to assist in the digestion or tolerance of the amino of the broken down protein that this is required. The wrong formula can be life threatening. The correct formula, life saving. Reimbursement in the past was contingent upon the passage of a nasogastric tube, which was for some patients was necessary in order to increase the volume of formula and calories by giving nasogastric feedings throughout the whole day. But if you give an allergic patient a formula to which they're going to have a life-threatening reaction with a nasogastric tube, they can still die from that formula. They need a change in the formula. They don't need the nasogastric tube. A requirement in the past, subsequently recently removed after our productive communications with the Minnesota Council of Health, has been the requirement for malnourishment. Long before some patients will become malnourished and have the indication for this formula, they may have died from an anaphylactic reaction. So it's nonsensical for many patients to have that as a prerequisite. And again, through communications, that requirement hopefully has been and will be removed. I would also like to take this opportunity to thank Nona Narvaez, who was key in the events leading up to today. Many of you know her. Unfortunately, she's ill and under doctor's orders not allowed to attend. But I thank her for all her work in proceeding. Again, the solution to the problem is the correct solution. It's elementary, and with that, I'm available for any questions.
Dr. Stillerman, I'm looking at the PowerPoint presentation on page 3, the relevant prevalence of allergic disorders, and it looks like, are we talking here in this the language of the bill about the GIT food allergy? Am I?
Okay. Page 3?
Yes, in the middle of the page where it says relevant prevalence of allergic disorders.
The purpose of that slide is to show you, if you look in the first, that is IgE or typical allergy-mediated disease. And what you'll notice is on the left bar, on those patients under the age of 5, the peak prevalence of food allergy is between 1 and 2 years of age. And it reaches 6 to 8% of the population. By the age of 5, it's down to about 2 to 3%. But again, that refers to the specific patients who have IgE-mediated disease. And the key point is that for those patients who have that problem to cow milk and soy protein allergy, a high percentage of them will have outgrown it. So if they can get the correct formula in the first few years of life and avoid the life-threatening challenges, they can hopefully outgrow their problem, and it isn't a lifelong problem for patients with those conditions.
So Dr. Stillerman, I understand you were very helpful in developing the language that we've adopted here with the amendment.
Correct.
And so am I correct to say that the allergic rhinitis, asthma, atopic dermatitis, and food allergy, kind of general food allergy, are not included in this bill?
No, it is. What we refer to the word allergy would be IgE-mediated, and it is included, but for IgE-mediated to food proteins of soy, cow's milk, etc. But you're correct, it eliminates other conditions such as asthma, allergic rhinitis, etc.
Would, for example, Dr. Stillerman, a peanut allergy?
A peanut allergy wouldn't be relevant here because the person could avoid the peanut, and if that's all they had, they could eat the cow's milk and the soy and the wheat, etc.
Okay. Are there any other questions?
This is largely for cow milk, soy milk, and perhaps a few other ubiquitous allergens.
Okay. I think it would be helpful too to hear from the parents as to as to what the issues are for them. But Senator Prettner-Solin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Silberman, I'm sorry I stepped out for a minute, so maybe this question was asked, but I'm wondering if you can address the cost of this product, why it's so much higher than other formulas.
Dr. Stillerman.
Okay. I didn't set the price, but the reason it's an expensive formula is that the origin of the amino acids has to be engineered up front. So instead of some of the other formulas, what are called extensively hydrolyzed formula, they may take cow's milk or soy milk and then put an enzyme in, which would be like a scissor, and it would go and cut the long protein at selected points, still leaving some areas of long chains that would be difficult to absorb or that patients could have reactions to. Here, they de novo start with manufacturing the amino acids. So if you would see it as a link of your watch, instead of taking the strap that's already developed and then cutting it into segments, they have to manufacture the links to give to these patients up front. And then the body takes it from there.
Dr. Stillerman, just is it individualized?
Is the diagnosis?
The therapy? The therapy is
very much individualized. It should be arrived at with a correct diagnosis. Not every adverse reaction to food is going to require this. And the respective physician, whether it's an allergist, gastroenterologist, or pediatrician, should establish the diagnosis and confirm that the diagnosis exists up front, from which patients are going to benefit from this. The language as currently written will allow a 90-day trial period to prove that the patients in fact benefit from this if it couldn't be established beforehand, but it does need to be individualized.
Senator Prettner-Solin.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Stillerman, I'm not sure if you're indicating that the treatment needs to be individualized. Is there a formula that needs to be put together? Is that put together by a pharmacist or by a pediatrician, or how is that arrived at?
Dr. Stillerman.
Thank you. The diagnosis needs to be established that the individual has an IgE allergy-mediated, for example, reaction to cow's milk, etc. The American Academy of Pediatrics has said that in infants suffering from that problem, the next best formula for that is not soy, which unfortunately is too often prescribed. And the next best formula is either an extensively hydrolyzed formula or an amino acid-based formula, what we're addressing today. So there are already recommendations for that. So the patient would have to have that diagnosis established and then one of those appropriate formula chosen. And it really shouldn't be the pharmacist determining it, in my mind. It should be the pediatrician, the allergist, or the gastroenterologist.
Dr. Stillerman, I think what we're trying to get at is, does it come in a can and one size fits every child?
Yeah, it comes in a can, and there are recommendations, and there's a dietitian expert who can address that further, but it's manufactured and reconstituted in a very simple fashion.
So it is every child would receive the same level of whatever is in there?
Correct. It would be reconstituted in the same way, and the introduction of that formula would be the same for each child. What would differ would be how many other food allergens that patient has. Obviously, the fewer other food allergens, the more on the, that patient can rely on the caloric, protein, carbohydrate, and fat sources from other foods. But in children with multiple food allergies, where there's a broad range of problems, not just peanut, milk, egg, wheat, soy, etc., chicken, that sort of patient would have to rely more heavily for a longer period of time on this as their source of nutrition.
Senator Prettner-Solin.
So, thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Silverman, Stillerman, I'm sorry. I still don't understand if this comes from a pharmacist. Is that, do they go to a pharmacist? Is a prescription made, and do they receive the formula from a pharmacist?
They can get it from a pharmacist, but they can also get it, as I understand, through the and the parents can and through the internet and from the companies themselves. Is that correct?
Madam Chair and Senator Prettner-Solin, I have some parents here who might be able to answer some of these questions because they do this daily. So
that's fine, but I think Senator Prettner-Solin wants to ask something else.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Dr. Stillerman, no, really where I'm trying to get to is, are there alternatives? Are there generic formulas? Does somebody own a patent? Are the parents being taken advantage of and held hostage to one form of intervention here?
Well, there are alternatives. The alternatives, as I mentioned, rather than a fully digested, if you look at my handout on page number 2, the bottom right-hand corner, are the four classes of formula. Number 1 and 2 are the regular full protein soy and cow milk. The second choice is an extensively hydrolyzed formula, and again, there's no generic, although it's significantly cheaper. And then you can see the bottom one is an amino acid-based formula. And clearly, for some patients, it's appropriate to go from regular formula to extensively hydrolyzed formula, and if that doesn't work, then through an amino acid-based formula. But there are now scientific studies that for some patients, it's actually better to start with success once they failed the regular formula and go to the amino acid-based formula first, have the patient thrive on that, and then go down to the extensively hydrolyzed formula, which is cheaper, but it's not a generic. So the difference in cost here comes from the fact that the cow's milk and the soy milk protein is derived from natural sources. The extensively hydrolyzed formula is more expensive, and that's because there's been some but not complete manipulation of the protein. And the amino acid-based formula is fully engineered from the beginning as individual blocks.
Senator Prettner-Solin.
Madam Chair, Dr. Stillerman, is there only one pharmaceutical company that manufactures this product?
No, there's at least two. There's at least two, and I believe there's a third, of which I'm not familiar, but there are at least two major companies that manufacture the amino acid-based formula, the extensively hydrolyzed formulas, and many more. I think there may be three with extensively hydrolyzed formulas or more. And, of course, the regular formula is many, many, many.
And, Madam Chair, Dr. Stillerman, are they cost competitive?
Are they what?
Are they cost competitive? Are they,
I honestly don't know of the prices of the individual comparisons between Company 1 and Company 2 of the amino acid-based formulas, but I've used both. I don't know the individual comparisons.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Dr. Stillerman, just kind of following up in a similar vein, and maybe the parents have looked into this and could answer this too. Do you know whether we're paying more for the same type of product in this country compared to, say, Canada or other countries? Is that a problem, or is this the actual cost of producing this?
Dr. Stillerman.
I have no information on the cost comparisons of this country or any other country.
Maybe the parents might be able to give us some instruction in terms of what they've encountered.
Sure.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair and members
yes,
of the committee. And,
Senator
and with respect to, these are some of the questions that obviously the health plans have been asking, and the whole drug industry is asking, you know, the questions that you ask are very pertinent. And so my hope is that these problems that we have with price and monopoly, really, of these products does not prevent us from covering this very small group of children, because that's an issue that we really need to address here in terms of healthcare reform, as the two of you know we've been working on and dealing with. But this is a very small group of children dealing with a very, very rare condition. So we're not really asking to open this up to every, you know, child with every food allergy. This is a very rare condition. And the parents are here to testify, Madam Chair, so they can talk about their experiences. So if you're ready, they'll be happy to start.
Why don't we proceed with that then?
Natalie first.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I have Ms. Natalie Waters was here with her son, and I have to confess that they are the first ones who came to me at the beginning of the month, and I was not even sworn in. I was cleaning my office, and they came to train me about this issue and to educate me about their...
Welcome to our committee.
You can go with Ami Henry if you don't want to sit with Mommy.
We have enough hands back there.
Okay. Henry's going to disappear. Nope.
Oh. Mommy better take baby.
Oh, it would be okay if he sits with Mommy. We've done that before. Sure.
Yeah, of course. He didn't want to. A second ago. Okay. Stop crying.
Okay. My name is Natalie Waters Seam, and this is my son, Henry Seam. He is 2.5 years old, and he has eosinophilic gastrointestinal disorders. He also has acid reflux and severe eczema and environmental allergies. Henry? You're okay, honey. You're okay. Henry looks normal. He's a little fussy today. This is nap time.
Oh, Henry.
Honey, you're okay. You're okay.
No, mommy.
I've got you, Henry. His reactions to solid foods.
No,
We're going to go home in a minute.
We all?
I've actually heard this before.
Yes, Henry. Let's put Bart on instead of me.
Is he speaking for all of us?
I think he
is. I apologize for
Please don't apologize. We're glad that you're here.
Yes.
So Mr. Hayes, I knew it was you. You look like your dad.
Oh, thanks.
But I don't think I ever saw him with quite as much facial hair. But
once in a while he does. Well, thank you. Again, my name is Bart Hayes, and I'm here today with my wife, Karen, my two boys, Delson, who's 5, and Mosley, who will be 2 at the end of this month. At 2 months old, we started noticing some problems with Mosley, and his bowel movements were very unpleasant. Lots of mucus and spots of blood. Being familiar with food allergies in our family, we began eliminating foods from my wife's diet as she was nursing and quickly started eliminating more and more foods. It seemed like as we eliminated foods, he would get better for a little while and then get worse again. At about 5 months, we saw our allergist, Dr. Stillerman, who referred us to a gastroenterologist. We had a preliminary diagnosis of eosinophilic colitis, upon which we were given basically 3 options, which were to quit breastfeeding at about 6 months old and switch to an amino acid-based formula, to continue on the path we were on and risk a declining health for our child, or what was called a total elimination diet, where the mother basically limits her diet to 5 foods: sea salt, sweet potatoes, turkey, white rice, and pears. We chose that option to start with, and those were the only foods my wife ate for about a month. And when things ultimately didn't get better, we went in for a sigmoidoscope and a biopsy and got a confirmation of the eosinophilic colitis, upon which we immediately weaned Mosley and got him on Neocate, one of the 2 brands of amino acid-based formulas. Our first month's supply was $650, none of which was covered by the insurance companies at that time. We appealed to our insurance company, which was a privately held or a self-insured company at that time, and were rejected on the idea that insurance companies don't cover baby formula, which, of course, this is not your typical baby formula. Upon the appeal, we were rejected, again saying that the insurance company doesn't cover over-the-counter drugs. And since this is not technically a drug, it has no products in it that are, restricted, I guess, under the FDA. You know, they say it's not a medicine, so they don't have to cover it. And we were told that there is no further appeals to that process. The decision was final and binding. We appealed then to that was through our prescription benefit carrier. We appealed to our primary insurance company, and through many months, we still never got any coverage. At one point, we got partial coverage through an insurance company, but no explanation. We got a small check in the mail, but we didn't know what exactly it was for. Mosley, after about a year old, started trying solid foods again, and he's completely off the Neocate. We believe that we're an example of how getting this done early and switching to the formula can allow the child to heal their guts, so that they don't need to go into any further treatment with this product. So we're done. We incurred over about 8 months about $3,500, $4,000 in Neocate costs, but are grateful now that we were able to do that and moved on. Part of that time, I should say that I became unemployed, and we applied for WIC benefits, and WIC does cover the cost of the Neocate, or at least partially, I think about 30%. So we received some benefit from them.
Okay, thank you, Mr.
Thank
Hayes.
You very much.
Any questions? Is there anybody else? Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
That covers everything.
Would you like to speak? A special one, if they can cover
I told that.
Let's go to temporary.
Just going to talk. I talk. What is that?
There we go. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you so much. My name is Jennifer Rudy. This is my son, Anders. And at about 6 months, well, actually about 4 months old, Anders seemed just fine, but he had some very severe eczema. And when we were starting to introduce him to rice cereal, he would have some violent episodes of just vomiting, really, for about an hour and a half. Very serious, drop in blood pressure afterwards and just passing out in between. It was not pretty. Okay. And at that time, through some of these episodes, we came to test him for food allergies, and at that time he was diagnosed with a milk allergy. And so we tried to get him onto Nutramigen, which is it's not Neocate, it's the level before that, which he did not tolerate. He's still splitting skin from his head all the way down to his torso, just dry. And he also suffered a lot of these gastrointestinal problems, very colicky, really horrendous stools and a lot of discomfort. I tried to eliminate a lot of these foods from my diet and pretty much stopped producing breast milk at that point. So it was really necessary for us to find a formula that was going to sustain his life. And since we were having problems introducing these foods, it turned out, we later found out, he had a food protein intolerance to rice. So feeding him rice was not an option. So we started him on the Neocate. A year later, we also found out that he was allergic to not only milk, but also egg, soy, peanut, tree nut, fish, shellfish, and sesame seeds, which he's still allergic to these things. But obviously some other formulas, like soy-based formulas, were not an option for us. Giving him a lot of other starter foods certainly weren't going to meet his caloric and nutritional needs. So this formula was necessary for the sustenance of his life. When we appealed to our insurance company on this, we were told that the reason he was being denied coverage.
Hi. Anders, hello.
Was because he.
I think he was speaking to Mr. Espel.
He was denied coverage because he was able to self-administer this formula. The fact that he was not receiving this through enteral tube feeding disqualified him, even though the diagnosis, his, you know, the administration of the formula did not affect his medical dependency on this formula. So essentially he was being denied because he had the ability to drink from a bottle. My question to the insurance company was, did a straw count as a tube and would be glad to use it? But so we are off the formula now. Yes. At about 2.5, 3 years old, he did outgrow the food protein intolerance to rice, and so we were able to use rice milk now instead of this formula. And that's been a tremendous price break for us. When I started purchasing the formula, and this was his sole nutrition for several months there, it was $36 a can. By the time I'd finished, and a can lasted about a day and a half. By the time I finished, we were paying $46 a can. It was, we ran it through prescription, through the pharmacy to help track some of it, but I did have the ability to go to the pharmacy and just request the order, but it had to be a special ordered formula. But as you can see, the cost was really tremendous to us. So.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Have anyone else? Bye-bye, Anders.
Well, Madam Chair and members of the committee, if you have any questions for the parents, I know that some of them are your constituents, and I'm sure they will be glad to have a conversation with you about their experience. And, of course, as a parent, I'm here to ask for your support as well, because I feel that it's just so important that we pay attention to these issues. And as you heard from the parents, most of these children really outgrow this condition. And also, as you know, as a parent, you want to do what is easiest, really, to feed your children. So you don't want to be dependent on a formula that is so expensive, difficult to obtain. So most parents are just looking for the day that the children will outgrow these conditions so that they can eat just normal foods. Would you like?
Of course. Yes, please.
Yes.
Actually, my name is Jeffrey Levine.
I just want to say, Mr. Levine.
Thank you very much. I'm actually thrilled to be before you. I guess, would be classified as one of the babies. I'm somewhat of a medical anomaly to be an adult with eosinophilic disease. And while the babies typically are born or have it and are fortunate to some degree to grow out of it, unfortunately, again, I'm in this very, very, very tiny, tiny percentage of adults who typically grow into the disease in their 30s. And in my case, in my mid-30s, I began having just really weird symptoms. I would occasionally have these terrible stomach aches. I would throw up, I'd vomit, no explanation. And that started occurring in the early 90s. And while I was never hypochondriac, I didn't really think a big deal of stomach aches. But it became more and more frequent, began to interfere with my work. And by mid-96, I was throwing up sometimes three times within a 24-hour period. Began seeing a multitude of doctors. They'd open up your mouth and say, listen, my heart. They say, you're fine. It's stress. It's this. It's that. It wasn't until the end of 1996, ended up in Mayo, and they scoped my stomach, and they found my stomach was full of eosinophils, which is basically, well, they theorized at first, in the year 2000, finally concluded that the eosinophils were being drawn in my stomach because of an autoimmune response, basically food allergies. Again, making long story short, after having been on a wide multitude of drugs, including several different chemo drugs to try to control it, I still had problems either from the drugs or still having stomach aches. Therefore, it was rather radical approach, but in March of 2000, my doctor at the Mayo Clinic said, Jeffrey, here's an idea. Go on elemental formula. You'll go on for a week or two, let your stomach calm down, and we just want to determine for sure, is it a food allergy? And what we'll do, we'll rapidly add back food, and hopefully within 6 months, we'll know if you have a stomach ache after eating a certain food, skip it, and hopefully everything will be fine. Therefore, this was my diet. They're 400 calories per packet. Lived on this, which it was kind of like Gilligan's Island, three-hour tour, ended up being 3.5 years living on this. What happened, I was never able to tolerate any foods, and it was a truly awful ordeal. Yet, I was thankful that this type of product existed, because truly, it was either this or being a high dose of prednisone or types of chemotherapy, interferon alpha, cyclosporine, etc. What happened when I initially went on the formula, I really not had much interaction with my insurance company. And my doctor wrote a letter, an appeal letter to my insurance company, and I really had no problem. My case was so unique and so severe. They covered it, and the process was once a year, I'd have to appeal it, and things went fairly smooth. Fast forwarding then, in the end of 2003, Mayo put me back on the 7-drug concoction, which allowed me to resume eating. And needless to say, I was thrilled to rejoin society. If you think of how critical food is to any of our human interactions. But what happened by spring, almost a year ago at this point, I was once again having trouble. I was having troubles with the drugs, and they were losing their effectiveness, plus terrible side effects. So I reached a crisis point where, again, I had to resume the elemental diet. That time, I did run into some difficulties because my insurance policy had been revised, and they were no longer counting this as being covered under the diet unless the person had a feeding tube. Skipping all the intricate details, I was able to finally go before the appeals and obtain coverage for another year. Bringing to the present time, I'm fortunate that I'm once again eating food, courtesy of being on an experimental drug that I'm currently receiving. Looking toward my future, it's quite tenuous in that wherever I go, whenever I travel, I always make sure I do have this because, in essence, I have no idea, nor do the doctors, honestly, why my body at times decides to attack itself. In essence, I eat food, and my white blood cells are there thinking it's being attacked by a foreign invader. So I guess in summation, I'm very happy that this event is occurring now. This is something that I've dreamt about for a long time, and I just want to say thank you so much for supporting this bill. I think it's long overdue and very meaningful.
And Mr. Levine, I thank you for sharing your story with us, because, and I think it's interesting because I thought this was only, you know, with children, and we learn something every day here, you know, working in our committees.
Sure.
Do you understand that it sounds like you were able to work this out among the various doctors and then the insurance company and yourself. So you've had coverage for most of the time you've...
Right. Okay. With a footnote, but there's always that anxiety. Again, in my situation, it's funny because when I would mention people I'm on an elemental diet or I can't eat food, the typical response is, oh, you're drinking Ensure. Or there was always a situation, I would tell people I'm allergic to food, and they really can't grasp that right. When I say I'm allergic to all food. A funny story, I was visiting relatives out of town, and when I said I'm allergic to all food, my cousin comes back and said, listen, I just squeezed some fresh orange juice, it'll be good for you. And they don't get it. It's like I'm allergic to food. 5 minutes later, I mean, some bran muffins, it's good. I mean, the fact is, to be allergic to food, totally everything.
Yeah.
Anything would enter my stomach, my body would reject that.
So you understand that the amendment we adopted would not pertain to you, because it does go... There's a limit of 5 years.
Can I?
Sure. Dr. Stillerman.
Sorry. The amendment, or as it stands, is that for IgE-mediated, or in other words, the allergy, as I said, in the true sense of the word allergy, mediated diseases, for those patients who outgrow their disease, the vast majority of them by 5 years, that one is limited. For some of the other diseases that Jeffrey has, eosinophilic esophagitis, etc., those diseases are increasingly being diagnosed in younger children, most often in older children, ages 7, 10, up, and we're starting to see the complications in teens and in adults. And it's my understanding that as the bill's proposed now, the exclusion is for IgE-mediated diseases, and that's for the vast majority of allergy patients and patients that we're dealing with. But it doesn't exclude patients like Jeffrey with those much rarer eosinophilic enteropathies, which can present slightly later.
Okay, then I know we're going to hear from the plans as to, you know, what how they interpret this language. I didn't understand that. I guess I thought that. So you're telling me that the things that are listed, the cystic fibrosis, amino acid, organic acid, fatty acid, metabolic and malabsorption disorders, and food protein-induced enterocolitis syndrome, those things are not the IgE?
Correct.
Okay, Dr. Stillerman, thank you. Mr. Levine,
I would like to just clarify one other point or answer a question you raised. There are actually three major manufacturers of elemental formulas. Okay. In terms of pricing, the pricing is relatively, give or take, a few dollars one way or another. It's very competitive. However, each product, I believe people respond differently. For example, the first product I was on, actually a side effect was diarrhea from the formula. Yeah. So therefore, I think it's important to broadly define elemental formula depending how each person will respond to the different manufacturer's product.
Okay, Mr. Levine, thank you very
much.
Thank
you very much.
Thank you, Senator Torres-Ray, do you have anybody else?
No, Madam Chair. So I would very much appreciate if a member of the committee can move a motion for me.
Senator Torres-Ray, and you'll have to explain to me, I guess. I apologize I didn't talk to you ahead of time, although we talked yesterday, I think, about this.
Yes.
Do you understand that when we do this as a mandate, that there's a significant number of people who are self-insured who may very well not be covered?
Madam Chair, I, in fact, plan to have a meeting with the parents today about that. I do understand that, and I do want to have a conversation. They have come really far. I have here some of the members that represent the health plans, and we're going to have this conversation because we understand that. So we're going to have a conversation right after this committee to see what's the next step for our,
right.
Because we want to make sure that we have as many kids covered as we possibly can. So if we have to do it through this venue or through some kind of an agreement with the health plans, we will do that. But they are very open to do that with us. So
we'll
have the conversation.
Senator Torres-Ray, I understand that you've been working with the health plans. They've been working to perhaps put this in their medical policies so that people who are self-insured groups would automatically have this coverage. It would be on their menu of covered items. And so that means that people who so if they agree to that, you may not want to pursue the mandate, which will cover, you know, some fraction. I don't remember the number anymore.
That's correct, Madam Chair. I'm kind of in between rock and hard place because the health plans are telling me definitely we will do this, and the parents are saying, are you sure, Senator Torres-Ray, that this is going to happen? And, of course, you know, I want to trust that that's indeed what's going to happen. So I want to have them together to make sure that if we move in that direction, of course, we don't want a mandate. It would be ideal if we could just have an agreement, and that would be, I think, the ideal situation. So we'll proceed with that.
Would anybody from the health plans like to speak to this issue?
Would you like to?
Ms. Kmit, it might be helpful here for the committee, because I wonder if you continue to work. I think the bill has met the deadline in the House. Am I correct?
Madam Chair, it's actually going to be heard at 2:15.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
Today. Members of the committee, I'm Catherine Kmit from the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, and I know that we made a presentation to you, to this committee, a couple of weeks ago, and in that presentation we talked about the pie charts of where Minnesotans get their health insurance and how the chart has changed because there's been a dramatic movement from the fully insured market, which the state of Minnesota can regulate, to the self-funded or self-insured market, which is outside of your reach. And when this legislation first came up, we began a dialogue with the proponents of the legislation to talk with them to understand what the conditions were, and in fact had a presentation with Dr. Stillerman and our medical directors, which was very helpful. And the medical directors did agree that these are certain conditions that ought to have coverage for these particular with these particular supplemental formulas. It is important, however, to also be cognizant of cost, and we want to be sure that it's not that the language that has been developed is not so wide open that it would allow anyone for any particular condition to qualify, but it should be for those specific conditions that Dr. Stillerman has been talking about. An alternative to putting a mandate into statute would be to have a working group perhaps get together and talk about the possibility of making changes to our medical policy. And the reason that I would I think this might be a better option is we did this several years ago when a bill to mandate coverage of cancer clinical trials was being considered by the legislature, and because of the concern about cost, and also because it would have only applied to the fully insured market.
What is that percentage, Ms. Kmitch?
The percentage of the fully insured market right now is 27% of the market in Minnesota. So 27% of Minnesotans currently are covered under a fully regulated plan. So that and over 40% of Minnesotans are covered by self-funded plans. Like this gentleman just testified to, his insurer was the administrator for his plan, but unfortunately it was his employer that was making the decision not to cover this particular supplemental formula. The insurance company was merely administering the plan based on the employer's wishes. So going back to the work group, what happened was legislation passed a couple of years ago that created a work group that was under the jurisdiction of the Departments of Health, Commerce, Human Services, and DUER, and we formed a work group to understand what the parameters were, and in the end, after many months, came up with a policy. And this was, we had to do it this way because of antitrust concerns. As insurance companies or health plans, we are very cognizant of the fact that we must not be in the room talking about how we're going to cover something or how we're going to pay for something. That would be a clear violation of antitrust, and we do not engage in those kinds of practices. However, if we are asked to meet and discuss this due to a request from the legislature, then we are exempt from that restriction. So that was one option that we had considered with the proponents. They, I know that there's a effort nationally to try to adopt a mandate in all of the different states. We talked with the proponents about this. They decided they would prefer to have the language in the state mandate. We are certainly open to talking with them if they would prefer to have it be if we pursue this other alternative. I think personally we think that that would be better, because once we adopt this as our overall medical policy, self-funded companies, large employers come to the health plans and say, we want you to administer our services for our employees. What is the latest medical policy coverages that you would recommend, and it's a dialogue that goes on, but they tend to go along with whatever the medical policy people suggest. So we think that that would actually reach more people and certainly would likely have addressed this situation that this gentleman was discussing in the past. So, but again, we're trying to be responsive to the parents and the families who have children with these conditions, and that's why we ended up here today.
Right, and this does not usually happen when we're talking about mandates. And this doesn't happen to very many. Well, it's a very expensive proposition for the families.
Certainly there is going to be, Madam Chair, certainly there is going to be a cost impact.
Yes.
And we recognize that.
Right. And so the fact that, and I appreciate that you've been working with Senator Torres Ray, and I think you are still doing that. Do you need a formal request to do that? I'm not actually making it here and now, well, but what do you need? Because I would like to see you do something within the law to work something out if you can. That doesn't mean that Senator Torres Ray will want to do that. I'd like us to have this resolved in this committee before we send it to the floor at Senator Torres Ray. That's why I'm asking. I mean, we might lay it over.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, it would be my preference that we pass this today, because what that would do is it would give us an opportunity to really go to the table together. I do want to respond to the request of the parents. I think they have been working very diligently to get to this point to ask for your support. I would like to make sure that we provide that support. Now, once we take this step, that does not prevent us from working out a deal or whatever it is that we call it, an agreement that we can present, and then I will not have to bring that to the floor. Well, but I would like to pass this in committee today.
Madam Chair, may I just add
that Senator Olson, yes, has a question, if she might, please.
Certainly.
That's
I'm
right.
Sorry.
Senator Olson. Or a comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Torres Ray. And I would just say that I understand the issue with the underinsured with the self-insured companies very well. That's 40%. The other 60%, assuming that the government-paid programs go along with the same mandate, would be affected by passage of this bill. And I'm not quite sure that I understand the logic why the self-insureds would be less likely to go along with covering this if we don't have the mandate than if we did have the mandate. It seems to me that if we make this part of our state's policy, and then they would be more likely to include these in self-insured policies as well. And considering that this problem has been ongoing and it's taken until this point, and we don't have this in existing insurance policies, then I would feel personally much more comfortable with a directive from this body that these are people who deserve this type of coverage.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Olson. I think that's my kind of my inclination right now. I do appreciate the work that is being done, of course, and I think my question has been exactly the same question. If they want to help us cover the other 40%, all they have to do is make an agreement and it will be done. So this mandate would not prevent them from doing so.
Senator Torres Ray, there's a process to that, however, you know, that they have to honor. I mean, and Ms. Commit, if you would.
Right. And Madam Chair, we also have to be, again, very, very careful to not engage in any kind of activity that could be construed as engaging in antitrust activities. And that's why we do have some language, a paragraph that we could consider, and maybe that would create this kind of a discussion that could go on, and it would require the this working group to report back in November of 07 that here's what the medical policy as developed includes. Now, I would say that if it is the author's desire to have this bill passed today, perhaps what could happen is have the bill get re-referred to the Health and Human Services Committee, and in the interim, we can continue to discuss this opportunity or possibility, and we'd be more than happy to work on that.
Ms. Kamen, I know. I think the bill will have to go because there's medical assistance provision in here. I want to share with the committee, the chair is not comfortable sending it out if you're not ready for the insurance concern. I need to say that. It's up to the committee here. I'm going to let you decide this, but I'm just telling you that if we can cover more people and that can be resolved, I think we ought to go that direction personally, but that's personal. The other part was as chair. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as I'm sitting here listening to the conversation, I agree. I think if we add Ms. Smith's language to the bill and leave the mandate in, send them both out, maybe it can get worked out.
That's an idea. Senator Vandeveer?
Madam Chair, I understand, I think, what you're saying. Is it possible to pass it and lay it on the table? Because I think what the author is saying is the leverage is
No, I think it has to be. It would have to be re-referred or to the floor, or and in this case, it's going to go to the Health and Human Services.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Yes, and I understand that procedurally.
Yeah,
that committee
and I understand your position. You know, my position is difficult just because this was proposed. I have not had an opportunity to talk to anyone about this. I understand it, and we talk about this. It seems like there will be no problem, but at this point, I would need some time to really talk to the families, talk to people who've been working. They've been working on this for years, and for me to come and just present this and in 2 minutes say yes, it seems unfair.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I'm comfortable that Senator Torres-Ray would do what she says she's going to do, which is this is going to have to be re-referred anyway, that she would talk in the interim. And I would like to move that Senate file 504 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Health and Human Services Committee. Would that be the correct?
That's where, yes. Yes, Senator Olson, that's where it would go. Senator Olson, on Senator Olson's motion, is there any discussion? Senator Gerlach?
Chair, you indicated some reservations a little bit ago. I'm open to following your lead and what you'd like to do with your committee.
Well, I have mixed feelings. I want to keep the pressure on to do something and to work this out because I think it would be wonderful if there were no necessity, and Senator Torres-Ray and I discussed it, if there were no necessity for a statutory resolution, that if we had an agreement that could be lawfully reached through a working group. Ms. Commit, to you.
Maybe this would give members of the committee some comfort. I just want to point out to the members of the committee that this is another example of how Minnesota's health plans are really different from other health plans across the country and in other states. And I think that there's a gentleman here, a lobbyist, who is working on behalf of this national organization, and he has told me this is highly unusual. And the fact that we sat down to work together and develop some language, again, is highly unusual. In other states, they would simply try to kill the bill. We did not try to do that. We have not lobbied against this bill. We have tried to work out an agreement. And I can give you our word that we would continue to work out a more suitable agreement that could benefit as many people as possible. The other thing about this language, it will not affect everybody because the large companies in Minnesota tend to be really good corporate citizens and take good care of their employees. But there are other companies that are based in other states who have employees here in Minnesota, and they're not always as responsive as the corporate citizens we have here in Minnesota. So, again, I just wanted to stress that what you're seeing is a really unusual thing, and I think it is as a result of the fact that we are a nonprofit health plan community here, and we are community-based, not focused on shareholders or other outside interests like that. And I think that makes a big difference in our willingness to work together on solutions.
Then I do take comfort in your comments, Ms. Commit. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
You know, I really don't like sending something out that's not dealt with by this committee, but if the word is to go forward and both sides, Senator Torres-Ray, I shouldn't say sides, but the parties here involved, the families, Senator Torres-Ray and Ms. Commit, working with the other health plans, and Dr. Stillerman, I would assume you would still be involved in the conversation. I appreciate that you met with Dr. Stillerman. I mean, I think obviously that this doesn't happen very often when mandates come forward. We don't have this kind of, participation, I think, at this level, and it is rare, and it's, I think it's very positive. And so I want it to continue. Senator Scogin.
I think I feel like you feel and would like to keep it here till it's fixed.
Yeah.
We have
Senator Olson's motion, Senator Vander, and then Senator Olson.
To that motion, Madam Chair, I'm wondering if she'd consider withdrawing it. I have to agree with the Chair. It sounds like they're working towards a solution. They don't have one. I have an interest in the bill. I'm an author on it. And if there's problems and they don't seem to be getting somewhere in the next couple days, I'll be the first one to you know, if we bring it back up to rock it out of here, but...
The option would be to lay it on the table until and have you work on it and come back. I don't know, though, if you're talking about November, I don't know that Senator Torres Gray is willing to go for a report in November. Yeah. So
We would have to work it out within the next few days because the deadlines are here. So
well, the deadline, we're okay for the deadline on a policy like this. It doesn't have to go to finance.
Mid-April.
No, it doesn't have to go to finance. Excuse me, to human services.
It might be a fiscal note on Section 2. That's right. But so we do need to act here before, what is it, April 2nd?
Madam Chair, just for clarification, I'm not sure that I understand, and maybe I'm missing something. I'm not sure that I understand the nature of the problem that we're facing. I guess to me, and again, maybe I'm happy to be told if I'm missing something here, but to me the question is, are we going to require insurance companies to the extent that we can to put in place coverage for this type of medical issue? And if we do that, more than likely, in my mind, others will fall in line. The other self-insured companies. But even if they don't, we will have provided coverage for where we can control it. In terms of working something out, and the explanation we've heard, I haven't logically been able to understand why that is going to make it more likely that we're going to have more children who would receive coverage. It seems to me, so maybe I'm missing something.
Senator Olson, I think that you can't assume, or that we shouldn't assume that that it will be picked up by self-insureds. And in fact, I mean, we've heard testimony on one or two bills here that there is a cost to mandates. I don't know that you can quantify it. I haven't had that happen yet, but you can, I mean, certainly we can understand when we have to, we require that the insurance, that there be coverage on a health plan, that there is a cost to providing that coverage. I mean, it doesn't just grow on trees. It has to do with premiums.
Sure.
And so there is a cost. If we mandate it, it is, then it applies to those 27%, was it 27% of the insured? And that's, I think, is that the number of insured? So that's 27% of the insured people in Minnesota.
And members of the committee, I'm sorry to interrupt, but just to remind you that passing this committee doesn't necessarily prevent us from working on
Senator
this.
Senator Torres Ray, I understand.
So I understand your hesitation not to pass a perfect bill.
Well, Senator Torres Ray, I've kind of committed to doing that, but
okay.
No.
No, that's fine. But just saying, you know, that I will absolutely work diligently after we finish here, so that if you pass it in here, that doesn't necessarily mean that we're just going to stop there and it's going to continue to go without, you know, addressing this issue. So I guess my promise to you is that if you want to, you know, pass this, and then we will immediately, you know, start the conversations. And if I just need to be given some time to talk now about this and present this language, and I just don't know how long it's going to take. So if I don't get your support here to keep moving forward, I'm just afraid that this is not going to go anywhere. So I'll appreciate the support in this committee, and then I will continue to work, and maybe when it comes to the floor, it will have the amendment and everything will be ready. If it ever comes to the floor, it may be.
Senator Torres Ray, you weren't here when I was criticized on the floor of the Senate for letting a bill out of the committee.
Sorry.
That wasn't ready. And I took that to heart. And
yes.
So I'm sensitive to that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Criticism.
Sorry
about
that.
And the interest of the committee clearly is the mandate issue and required coverage. I think the sense of the committee, when I look at the authorship, you know, those of us, I mean, am I a co-author? I'm concerned about this issue. I have known about this issue now for a little over a year. I think that we probably would go ahead, Senator Olson, and pass the mandate, even if it applied to only 27% of people with coverage. But if we could see them work together to make sure that this was part of medical policies, where when you when the self-insured goes and says, what's on the menu, you know, what what's there, what's on the list, this is what's covered, and they make those choices. But they tend, I think the tendency would not be to pick and choose. And if you're looking at something that's relatively expensive, and I never knew anybody who had this issue in their family until I heard of this issue a year ago. So,
well, yeah. Madam Chair, just
the company's choosing it.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
That's all right.
Madam Chair, just in the conversation and in everything we've heard, then it just seems to me that by passing this bill, we're not doing anything to make it less likely that these children will be covered. We are taking the step to the degree that we can to make it more likely, and then hopefully this will become a part of that menu and something that will be picked up. But it doesn't seem like it would make it more likely if we don't pass this that that would happen. So I guess that's my reason for renewing my motion. Oh,
and Senator Olson, my hesitation isn't because I don't want it to pass. It isn't that I don't think it will. I think it will. And I think I would support it passing. So that isn't it. I'm just really reluctant to send something out of here that we didn't consider the insurance concerns. You know, not the insurance company's concerns, the insurance principles and how that has an impact, you know, on consumers. Yes, Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll go back to what I was originally suggesting, adding this commits language is really what we've done a lot in other committees. It's called comfort language to keep the conversation going. If it goes out as a mandate and a mandate only, it could die along the way in another committee. But if we add comfort language, it keeps the conversation going.
I do have a copy of a short paragraph of the so-called comfort language, if that would be helpful. I don't know if an amendment could be drafted.
Does that have the November?
Yes, and we could change that date. It does not have it says the Commissioner of Commerce shall convene a work group to review medical policy and other related issues regarding amino acid-based elemental formulas. The work group must include individuals with specific expertise on amino acid-based elemental formulas, medical directors from health plan companies, as defined in Section 62A.011 subdivision 2, and others identified by the commissioner. The commissioner shall report back to the legislature by November 1, 2007 on the progress made by this work group, and it could be an earlier date if you like.
Ms. Commit, and I wanted to explain that is needed because the plans cannot sit down and talk to each other and decide that they're going to do this across the board. They cannot do that.
Right.
I mean, antitrust law would prevent them from doing that. So we have the Olson motion.
Madam Chair, do you need a motion to add the comfort language?
Pardon me. Well, that's it.
I think what you
wouldn't do it. No, I don't know. Senator Olson, would you withdraw for consideration of this amendment?
Madam Chair, is it possible to just have a few seconds to talk to the author because they're having a conversation, or could we lay this over for a few minutes?
We can do that.
Okay.
We can do that.
I'll appreciate, Madam Chair, if you could give me a few minutes just to talk with the people and so that we can review this language, and then I will come back if that's okay with the committee.
Senator Metzen, is that okay?
I think that's fine. I just want to assure the author and Senator Olson, I don't think what I'm hearing from this committee, anybody's opposed to what you're going to do. And I don't know. It's just a matter of how we correctly do it, like the chairperson says, and I'm going to vote for something.
Yes.
This is needed. And now if we can fix it up better, I mean, we don't have a gun to our head today, do we? I mean, she's absolutely correct. When Senator Sol and I and Senator Scheid and others chaired this committee, we wanted the product to look, quite frankly, as good as it could leaving the door. So I'm not out to, you know, we're here to help. The comments I've heard, I see some head shaking affirmatively, and so I don't know. You want to visit now? Go ahead. If you can work it out in the next 10 minutes, fine. Otherwise, Monday's not going to be a killer date.
Well, then, Madam Chair, rather than having an amendment attached to this that might water down what we're trying to do, if it's all right with the author, I would prefer then that we try to work this out in a short period of time. I'd withdraw my motion, and hopefully then we can still rehear this in a short order, if that's possible.
Senator Torres-Ray, would today is the 8th of March. If we return here on Thursday the 15th. That's 1 week. Is that something you think you can work with? And Ms. Commit, I'm asking you as well.
Yes, and my guess is that you only need the two of us, and hopefully we don't have to ask the families to come back and Dr. Stillerman to travel back
work
to Minnesota.
Work it out.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I want
it
to be really understood that we're going to do something, and we're going to have some coverage when we leave this committee. We'd like it to cover as many people as possible.
We get it done.
Madam Chair, you have my commitment. Thank you for the
extra time. Thank you very much, Ms. Commit.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee.
We're going to lay
Senate
File 504 over until 1 week from today, March 15th.
Thank you,
Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, members of the committee.
So that's, do I do that? I don't know. Now, Senator Pretner Solon. Members, thank you. I think that we'll be glad we did do that.
Oh, okay. Go have a hot dog.
Where do they sell hot dogs?
Okay, you'll tell.
I'm sorry, I'm testing you too much.
That's all right. It's all right. It's
pretty fired up.
It's attorney legal.
But that's what that amendment was.
Spelling place here.
I'm the world's worst speller, but let's go.
That's okay. We're going to make progress.
Mayor, buy a bottle.
I know. So, are we losing?
I could have.
That the
requirement.
It's just making.
That's. They haven't.
This will give them time.
Senator Pretner Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes.
I have brought before you Senate File 608, which is a bill that came to me from a former constituent. And this bill seeks to do two things. First, it seeks to raise the minimum amount of insurance required to fly an airplane. And second, it seeks to clarify the state's position regarding injuries to innocent third parties as a result of an aviation accident. With respect to the former, the bill raises the minimum amount of insurance a pilot must carry in order to fly. The minimums have not been raised nor addressed since 1976. That's 31 years. The rates currently stand at $25,000, $25,000, and $50,000. This bill raises the minimums to $100,000, $100,000, and $300,000, which is consistent with automobile rates. With respect to the latter, the bill seeks to put into place a Commerce Department procedure regarding third-party liability. The procedure has not gone through the rulemaking process and, as a result, does not have the force and effect of law. This second part of the bill clarifies the duties and obligations of the insured. It simply clarifies that any avoidance from fraud provision must make an exception so as not to apply to liability coverage. The bill also provides against the ability of insureds and insurers from agreeing to settlement and then retroactively canceling the policy so the injured third party does not have recourse against the insurer. In drafting the legislation, it was suggested that we use the language from the automobile in statutes because it is clear and has been litigated, and therefore there should be fewer questions on the implementation of the language. In August of 2003, there was a plane crash in Grand Marais, Minnesota. There were three passengers in the plane, a mother and her two daughters, and the pilot, Charlie Erickson, and a passenger, Catherine Pearson, died in the crash. The two little girls, Grace, then 4 years old, and Lily, then 3 years old, survived. Catherine, Grace, and Lily all lived in Duluth at the time of the crash. These young girls had extensive medical injuries. Grace and Lily spent approximately 3 and 8 weeks, respectively, in various hospitals. When the girls emerged from the hospitals and the medical bills started arriving, their family was informed that the airplane insurance company was denying coverage. This started more than 3 years of litigation between the family and the insurance company. Finally, after more than 3 years, the parties entered into a settlement. By passing this bill, we assure that innocent third parties like the Pearsons would not have to go through such an ordeal. We do this by raising the minimum amount of insurance the pilots must carry, and we codify the existing department's procedure regarding liability coverage. And today I have with me Toby Pearson, the father of Grace and Lily and the widower of Catherine Pearson. And unfortunately, the attorney who represented the family was called away and wasn't able to stay for the hearing. So I'm hoping that Toby is able to answer everything.
I'll do my best.
Welcome, Mr. Pearson.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Toby Pearson. I'm the father of Grace and Lily Pearson, and I was married to Catherine Pearson. I'm here to ask you for support for this bill. There are two important aspects of the bill, as was outlined by Senator Solon. First, increasing the minimums, which haven't been addressed since 1976. And second, taking the Commerce Department procedure and putting it into statute. First, the minimums. In our case, the medical bills accumulated and the economic and emotional losses for our family far outweighed the insurance minimums, where they are in statute and where they will move to with this change. However, I realized in my conversation with some of the pilots and the insurance industry that an agreement of 100, 100, 300 as a compromise would be sufficient at this time.
Mr. Pearson, forgive me for interrupting. Senator Solon, did you want, Pretner Solon, did you want us to be dealing with the delete everything amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair.
The A2, am I correct?
That's correct. It probably would be best at this time
this
to
will
offer
put it
the
so
A2.
So that we are all looking on the, at the same page then. Thank Senator Pretner Solon offers the A2 amendment to put the bill in the shape we're going to be discussing from this point on. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Now, Mr. Pearson, weren't sure which piece of paper to look at, so now we're looking at the amended version. So you're looking at the 100, 100, and 300.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
So as I said, those numbers and this in this amendment represent a compromise between us and the insurance companies in conversation with pilots as well. The second part of the bill is to assure that future injured innocent third parties don't have to experience what I had to go through in trying to recover. I experienced the highs and lows of 3 years of litigation, hearings, mediations, and finally arriving at settlement over 3 years later. During this time, I unfortunately had to leave Senator Solon's district and move down to St. Paul, relocating my family, changing jobs, pay for all the medical bills, change the schools that Grace and Lily attended, and leave the very supportive community and friends and family in the city of Duluth. Generally, I had to change every aspect of my life and the lives of the children. By assuring that there is no avoidance for fraud as it pertains to liability coverage and putting the Commerce Department procedure into statute, no other family will have to experience what I had to experience for over 3 years. Again, the second part of the amendment also represents some compromise, as we've had very fruitful discussions with the insurance industry and pilots. In the initial bill, they had some concerns with some of the language, so we removed some of the language and changed it. We have not reached a compromise on this final language yet, but we continue to negotiate and discuss with the insurance companies. I think our goal for myself, my children, and for the insurance companies and pilots is all joint goal. We're working towards not having the instance of an innocent injured third party not being able to recover from anywhere, in this case, a 3- and 4-year-old girl. So it's my concern that Grace and Lily be able to be covered, or children who would be similar to them if an accident were to occur again in the future. And so that's why I'm trying to change this law to try to get to address that problem. I urge your support for the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Pearson. Are there any questions that anybody would have? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Pretner Solon, I have had several emails from constituents back home small plane owners telling me that passing this bill is going to put them out of business, and I'm very, very sympathetic to Mr. Pearson, and honestly, generally, I think, you know, the more protection we have for situations like this, you know, within reason, the better. But I did have a question. When you said that this was lined up with the automobile policy, the numbers in here are quite a bit higher than the numbers required for liability coverage for an automobile accident. I believe that would be like a minimum of $30,000 per person and $60,000 per accident.
Yeah, the numbers, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Senator Olson, the numbers are higher than automobile insurance. The concepts are similar in that you have the three forms of coverage for bodily injury, passenger, and I can't remember the other one off the top of my head. And as we were, as I said, as we were discussing with the insurance companies, the initial bill asked for $250,000, but when we talked to them and then heard from some pilots, they said that, you know, a range that they would be much more comfortable in is the 100, 100, 300. So that's how we arrived at that. Now, obviously, you know, the damage done from an airplane is much more catastrophic and has a tendency in general, although there are, unfortunately, very horrendous car accidents as well, higher medical bills and more likely result in death. So that's where the language came from as we were drafting it, and that's how we found kind of the compromise language in the amounts.
Thank you.
Senator Van De Veer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make sure I understand this. So the insurance company, after the accident, canceled the insurance and didn't think they had to pay?
Mr. Pearson.
Because I entered into a settlement and the attorney who is on the other side is here somewhere, I'm not sure how much I can comment on the exact nature of the case.
I don't want to put you in a position, but maybe the author. Is that your interpretation? Thank you. Insurance companies don't like mandates, but, you know, it's like they like every part of their job except paying claims. I mean, collecting the money, and they're real good at that.
The
mandates, but why does this happen? I mean, this is just bizarre.
Madam Chair, Senator, I think the when I was drafting the bill, the second part of the bill was pointed out that what it would do is it would prevent a insurer and an insured from getting together and agreeing on a lower settlement and then turning around and canceling the policy retroactively and then having the insured. In essence, they could take that money, pay down their house, then file bankruptcy, and then not have anywhere where the injured third party could go. So there is language in there that tries to address even that possibility of action.
Okay. And when I think what you've done with the amendment is take out the absolute liability, if I'm not mistaken. Yes.
Madam Chair.
That's lines 116 and 117 of the original bill. So that's no longer here. So, and this all relates only to the third, to any bodily injury, death, or property damage suffered by a third party. So I'm not sure that, I think that's a change as well, isn't it? Mr. Stang, yes. It seems that now we're focusing on that, the third party, not the pilot, not the person who secured the insurance policy, but the third party that's injured or further harmed or property damaged. So, Mr. Stang, am I right? Is that a difference?
Madam Chair, that did change from the...
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Prentner-Solin.
Madam Chair, I know that the Commerce Department had a problem with the absolute. Once that was removed, I believe they're staying neutral on this now.
Okay. But am I correct? Well, I guess maybe somebody, you know, from an insurer, if there is anybody representing insurance, people who write this kind of insurance. Yes, Mr. Bross is here, so maybe he can tell me, you know, tell us that. Are there any other questions here for Mr. Pearson? Senator Bandevere.
Not for the witness.
Okay. Maybe. Okay. Do you have anybody else, Senator Bretner-Solin? Okay.
No, unfortunately, Madam Chair, the attorney had to leave.
Okay. Then I have on the list Mr. Clark, Mr. Ashenfelter, if you want to come on up. Go right here. I guess maybe a couple of you can fit in there at once. You can just pull up a chair and... That's true. We
show that too.
Well, no, right. But we have about half an hour left here, so be to the point. But welcome to our committee. Well, and introduce yourself then. And
Madam Chair, my name is Dave Clark. I'm an aircraft sales manager at ASI Jet Center at the Flying Cloud Airport in Eden Prairie. I'm also president of the Minnesota Business Aviation Association. We're an organization that represents about 350. Business aviation professionals working for companies ranging from small companies to Fortune 500 companies. After reviewing the Senate file, I have some real concerns that it would obviously increase the aircraft liability limits fourfold, but more importantly, dramatically change the liability coverage requirements. While I believe the intention is good, I think it will most likely have the opposite impact that the authors seek. I foresee a few the following consequences if this legislation is enacted into law. First of all, it would decrease the number of insurers participating in an already limited aviation insurance market. There's 12 underwriters right now in the aviation market in Minnesota. And just a quick straw poll of those that we've contacted, which would be 8 of those 12, just informally have mentioned that they would have serious reservations about insuring in the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Clark, forgive me, was that in relation to the bill as introduced?
I don't think that would change much with the language that I've seen with the amendment.
Really?
Correct.
Okay.
Secondly, I think it would dramatically increase the cost of aviation liability insurance if it's still available. Again, if a lot of underwriters pull out, then the remaining companies are going to make their own decisions about how they're going to price their products, and we feel that that would dramatically increase. It would also probably lead to creative alternatives of insuring aircraft. Perhaps even some would choose to fly without insurance, which is obviously a concern. And at a minimum, it would greatly reduce the general aviation industry in Minnesota, particularly in outstate Minnesota, and could lead to unintended economic decline. So I think the effect would undoubtedly be that many would be forced to sell their aircraft, as some of the senators here have heard from their constituents. That is something that we're already seeing as a consequence, or move their aircraft to border states, something that's already happening for various other reasons. I believe that the legislation would further constrict the limited availability of liability insurance. It would drive up the cost. I guess I urge legislators to work with the aviation insurance industry to find ways that would cover these liability concerns and may even encourage more carriers to do business in Minnesota beyond the 12 that are here. So those are my comments. I thank you for your
Mr.
time.
Mr. Clark, if I may ask, as it is with auto insurance, when you purchase insurance, there is the required minimum, but is a person able to purchase more?
Yes, they are.
So
yes.
That... The 100 and 300 may not, it just seems to me that the cost for health care, you know, that's got to do with injury and or death, and not less than $300,000 per occurrence. Do you think that takes the cost up out of affordability?
Madam
isn't
Chair,
the 20, isn't aren't the former limits rather low?
I think I'm going to, Madam Chair, I'm going to defer that question to Steve Bruss. He's president of Wings Insurance. He can better answer that. From my perspective and from the organization, the people that I represent, I don't think that's the biggest concern with this bill.
Okay. In just a moment. Senator Prettner-Solin.
Yep. Madam Chair, before we move on to Mr. Bruss, I'd like to ask Mr. Clark if the aviators are not required to file with the Commerce Division, I guess, and if there isn't a requirement that they carry insurance.
Okay, Mr. Right. Bruss maybe is going to be able to answer that as well as my question. Mr. Bruss, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Steve Bruss. I'm president of Wings Insurance Agency. We're an aviation insurance specialist located in Eden Prairie. We've been in business for 23 years, and we are an independent agency. Therefore, we don't represent just one single insurance company, but all that are available in the state of Minnesota. I see this bill and proposed legislation, even in the revised form, as problematic for a variety of reasons. The limits proposed I don't see as problematic as they were in their original form, simply because there is availability for them. However, points 1 and 2 in the proposed legislation, where it mandates that an insurance contract, and I think that needs to be the focal point here, the insurance contract between the insured and the company cannot be voided or nullified based on any information provided throughout the underwriting process. That becomes highly problematic because the insurance companies depend on that information to underwrite a risk properly and price it accordingly. If they have inaccurate information, either knowingly or unknowingly fraudulent or omitted, they don't have the proper information to either price their product accordingly or decline to offer coverage whereby it would have to go to a higher risk insurance company.
Mr. Bruss, my question is, I think on the amendment it specifically relates to injury or damages suffered by a third party, whereas I think the original bill was across the board, even to the pilot and the insured, the actual insured party. If I'm not mistaken, that
Correct.
Applied there. So the amendment has taken that person out of the equation. It's just for the presumably innocent third party. Mike, you understand it that way as well?
I do understand it that way as well. The point I'm leading up to is that I think instead of mandating unavoidable insurance contracts, we should focus attention and effort on exploring different opportunities by the implementation of insurance standards within the aviation insurance industry, which now exist.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Olson.
I'd just like to say that from my perspective, these two subsection 1 and subsection 2 of subdivision 10 are probably, in my opinion, the most important and the most defensible parts of this bill. And that's why we have this kind of language in the automobile, in the No-Fault Act, because what this is intended to do is avoid collusion between an insured and the insurer after the fact, after you've already approved the policy. This doesn't say you can't go through your typical underwriting process. This says that once you've already accepted the policy premiums, that you can't, after the fact, go back and look and nitpick through the situation and look for some excuse to get out of coverage that would then impact an innocent third party that had nothing to do with any of those statements that were made. And so for the benefit of public policy, otherwise insurance policies become almost meaningless because you can always find something to try to challenge and make it very expensive and very difficult for an innocent third party who had nothing to do with this to be able to collect insurance that was supposed to be intended for their protection. So that's my response to the comment that you made. And the other thing I'd like to say is just after giving this some consideration and thinking about the fact that people who are purchasing planes, it's hard for me to believe that too many of them would be purchasing $25,000 policies anyway, just because the liability concerns are so large, and if they could afford a plane, this to me seems like a reasonable compromise.
Do you have anyone else to testify, or Mr. Bruss, did you want to say anything more, or you have someone else here as well? Oh, Senator Vandeveer may have a question.
Yeah, I do have a question. One thing I would comment is these aren't cars, and insurance is a little more difficult to thank Git for planes because I just fly an ultralight, but I know that it's not easy to get. Is it item number two, which is the on line 116? Is that the fact that no statement made can be a reason not to insure? Is that the biggest problem? I mean, let me ask you this: do you have a problem with 1.14?
Madam Russ. Chair, Senator, as an independent agency, we don't write the policies or conduct the underwriting. However, my survey yesterday of the aviation insurance markets, eight out of the 12 told me verbally they would withdraw from Minnesota should this pass, has indicated to me that those statements in line 116 are the statement or is the statement that is part of the biggest concern. And my comments with regard to implementing a focus regarding standards as a possible solution and perhaps a centralized database of information would give the underwriter accurate information in the beginning of the underwriting process so they wouldn't have to discover facts that were omitted after an accident occurred and thereby forming a problem during the claims process. That is the only point I was trying to make there. The insurance companies have shared with our agency that should this legislation pass, they will either increase premiums, and no one has given any speculation, but it's going to be 80%+ or more, and they would highly consider withdrawing from Minnesota because this legislation would require them to pay regardless of what the pilots represented or the insured represented. So if someone, an example could be someone could misrepresent it, get cheaper insurance from a premium standpoint, and they know that the insurance company is required to pay.
But, Mr. Bruce, again, my point was I think that Senator Pretner Solon's amendment dramatically changed the risk for the insurer by removing the absolute liability and then applying the void or the non-voidance provision to only any injury or damage suffered by a third party, which was not in the case in the original bill. I mean, so it does narrow the risk, I think, substantially from what the original bill did. I don't know, Senator Olson, do you?
No, I agree with you. It seems to me, Madam Chair, that if a person themselves is guilty of some kind of fraud with the insurance company or having done something not fully disclosed information, that they shouldn't be able to benefit from that by obtaining insurance coverage. I think this language narrows it to just protecting innocent third parties and prevents a situation just as was described where the insurance, and unfortunately, otherwise, we have the door open for this kind of collusion, and it isn't illegal in a situation where the policy is voided and the insured declares bankruptcy and the victim is left with no recourse against the insurance company. And I can just say from firsthand experience that leaving that door open leaves too much room for mischief in these kinds of situations.
Senator Vandeveer?
I don't know. Seems to me it requires them to insure over fraudulent statements, lies, bad information. I mean, how do you – and remember, these aren't cars. The market isn't quite the same. I mean, you don't have people just dying to get – well, fighting to get in here and write this kind of insurance. And there is a high risk of making it unavailable. That's all I'm saying.
Well, and Madam Chair, Senator Vandeveer, I guess I would just have to say again, I'd be surprised – if the policies went up to the degree that's being represented here, because my guess is that most people have coverage in this amount or more already anyway. And so the difference in what we're really trying to do here is we're trying to prevent, we're not trying to allow someone who's committed fraud any benefit, and they won't get any benefit under this or any misrepresentation. And we're not preventing the underwriting process from looking into this before someone purchases a policy. We're just saying they can't, after the fact, go back and use that as an excuse not to pay an innocent third party.
To that point.
Senator Vandeveer.
Thank you. Madam Chair, well, I understand what you're saying, but I think, one, you've made a couple statements like people would buy higher limits. People with planes, if you've ever, you know, been out and looked at them, they're not all rich people, and the insurance is a real problem. I mean, it is a huge issue, and you're going to have more people, if we're not careful, not having any. So while I have no sympathy for the insurance company that decided to not pay after they were, you know, and they clearly had an obligation to, I think you need to be extremely cautious here, and you are expanding substantially what you're asking them to insure over.
Madam Chair, can I ask, under this bill, and I'm just assuming that if an insurance company did have to pay the way the bill is written now, but the insured had misrepresented something to them, that insurance company would probably have some recourse against the insured in terms of an action to go back against that insured for the misrepresentation or the fraud against the insurance company?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson.
Yes, Mr. Pearson.
That is part of our goal, and that's part of how we tried to draft it, and that's my understanding of it, that we are not interfering with that contract relationship is referred to between the insured and the insurer, and that if in fact there was a problem, that the insurance company couldn't go back against its insured for some type of contribution claim or something along that lines. So that's not our intention to interfere with that. We're simply trying to address the innocent third party. Like in my case, it was the 3-year-old and 4-year-old girl. Should they be the one that have to go and try to get coverage from somebody? Or should it be between the two people who entered into the contract agreement to figure out who has to pay between themselves, but leave the injured third parties out of it?
Okay, Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and maybe Mr. Bruce could help address this. And I'm glad that Senator Solon has been willing to work a little bit with some of the numbers. But if I'm reading the language right, do you have any idea what, like, a recreational aviator would see an increase in premiums if this was to go into law?
Mr. Russ.
Madam Chair, Senator, the difference in pricing from what the current limit is now, $25,000, to the $100,000, $300,000, is the differential is probably a couple hundred dollars. But the highest pricing increase that we will see in our industry, and I'm referencing people on the other side of the spectrum in terms of aviation, not the small aircraft owner, but more so the corporate jet pilots and the charter fleets, the people that have fleets of aircraft, airlines, etc., is higher price increases because the insurance companies will now be required to pay for third-party liability by statute. And I'm in no way minimizing the tragedy of this event. I'm just offering up some possible alternatives to explore as solutions in terms of fraudulent application and or omission of information. Technology and standards exist that we could mandate the insurance companies to explore and utilize. Funds can be set up. I'm just, as a person who runs a aviation insurance agency in which 60% of our business is derived in the state of Minnesota, I will have a direct and adverse impact should this go through and many of our insurance companies withdraw from the state.
Senator Sparks.
To that point, and thank you, and I did talk with counsel a little bit, so if I'm reading this right, on line 1.9, that $100,000 per passenger seat would increase if it's of a larger airplane because the potential for more passengers to be on that airplane would drive that premium or that cost higher. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. Madam Chair, $100,000 is the minimum our agency will offer as coverage. We don't offer anything lower than that. Quite frankly, because of the litigious society we're in. And we quite typically offer limits, quote limits of 1 million combined single limit or higher.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
And I think that just makes my point for me that I would have been really surprised if somebody were buying liability insurance for those lower limits anyway. And Senator Sparks, there is a limit of $300,000 as the most, I think, for an incident. So if you had more than three passengers, you'd still, the most per occurrence that they'd have to pay under this bill is $300,000. But And one final comment I'd like to make to the witness about what you said about the technology available for underwriting. It seems to me that that's available for you, whether we don't need to mandate that you utilize that technology and to go through those things to improve your underwriting processes. You can certainly do that, and I would think the time to do that is on the front end. And then there's nothing in this bill that prevents you from failing to write an insurance policy if, when you go through and use that technology, you determine that the person applying for insurance hasn't been honest with you.
And I wanted to clarify something with Mr. Bruss. I wasn't sure which kind of airplanes you were discussing, because obviously I think commercial airlines like Northwest Airlines is not affected by what we're doing here, because I don't think we regulate them. Am I correct on that? We're looking at the statute. It looks like this might be for personal and recreational kinds of use of a plane, but can you tell me, can you maybe clarify that?
As I understand it, this would be applicable to personal recreational use, as you call it, but also corporate use as well, and corporate use can extend into large jet aircraft. We have a number of individual clients that have personal aircraft and use them for personal use, and they're large jet aircraft.
So this would not be for any commercial kind of aircraft. Is that your understanding?
I don't have enough information to comment on that.
Okay. I do want to point out for Senator Vanderveer that an aircraft means, if you're flying ultralights, any contrivance. The statute actually says that, so I think it does affect you.
This could be one that should be laid over for a little work.
So is there another gentleman who wished to testify here? We're going to keep moving here.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Ashenfelter, and I'm assistant general manager at a business that also happens to be in Eden Prairie, ASI Jet Center Incorporated. We employ 70 people in the aviation industry and do so with the help of the aircraft that would be affected by this type of legislation. We're a company that's built on aircraft sales, and then through these aircraft sales, we then hangar a lot of these type of aircraft, and as their costs go up, and their ability to insure their aircraft then goes away, our the amount of aircraft that we'd have in our hangars and such would significantly decline. So I want to thank everyone for listening to me.
Well, Mr. Ashenfelter, we appreciate your coming, you know, and expressing your concern, and I'm glad that you did. Have you done this before?
No, never before.
Aren't we fun?
Very much so, thanks.
Mr. Pecoraro.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Greg Pecoraro, and I represent the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association, also known as AOPA, which is the nation's largest aviation membership organization with over 411,000 members, including over 7,700 here in Minnesota. Headquartered in Maryland, AOPA is dedicated to promoting and encouraging general aviation throughout the country. We appreciate the tragic nature of the incident that inspired this legislation and express our deepest sympathies to Mr. Pearson and his family. I'm here today because our members are deeply concerned about the impact of Senate File 608 on general aviation in Minnesota. I'm not an insurance expert, and I know we've had some folks here today who are and others who could also help you with that, but we understand that if enacted, the provisions of this bill would make it nearly impossible for our members to get affordable insurance coverage for an aircraft in Minnesota. If the law is adopted as proposed, it will either force insurers to raise premiums far beyond the ability of the average pilot to pay, or drive insurers out of the state, forcing Minnesota pilots to fly without any insurance or register them in other states with reasonable standards. Senate File 608 would hurt general aviation through new mandates for aircraft insurance. And we've talked about that a little bit already. My understanding is that about 80% of the light aircraft fleet flies with coverage of $1 million for each occurrence, limited to $100,000 per person or less. And so most aviation insurance companies generally require a minimum of 500 hours flying time and an instrument rating for limits higher than $1 million, limited to $100,000 per person. So some of these limits might start getting might make it very difficult for our members to be able to be granted those terms by insurance companies. It might be a non-commercial policy, as they say. We've already talked about Minnesota's current limits, and so I won't go back into them again, except to note that only six states do require these kinds of standards. And of those six states, Virginia currently requires the highest level of coverage at $50,000 per person bodily injury, $25,000 for each occurrence of property damage, and $100,000 for each occurrence. The proposed levels would place Minnesota far above any other existing requirement.
Mr. Pecoraro, but I think we heard that the gentleman who writes the policy says they're not doing anything for less, what did he say, than the million. So, you know, it may be the requirement may be less, but it sounds like they're recommending to the purchasers
right.
that they
and
be adequate.
And we appreciate Senator Prentner Solon's movement in terms of changing the standards from the original requirements, and I think that those probably make it much more affordable for most pilots. I guess the real concern is that we understand that under the current provisions of, I think, even the amended language, aviation insurance would become difficult or extremely expensive to obtain because of the way that the liability would now be included in terms of still not having any exemptions for any kind of fraud or major misrepresentations or things of that nature. And without, as I said, without being an insurance expert, I don't know what the solution to that is, but it's our hope, as an organization that represents pilots, that the committee will take a very careful look at this, set reasonable standards of minimum liability coverage, and impose sensible liability requirements on insurers that will protect them from major misrepresentation or a violation of policy standards and allow them to continue to offer a wider range of policy options for our members here in Minnesota. To that end, we would encourage you to defer action on the bill today if that's possible. Instead, take a little time to consult with the aviation community, perhaps with the insurance community and others, to develop an alternative that will meet the goals of this legislation without creating conditions that will do serious harm to general aviation in Minnesota. AOPA stands ready to work with you, your staff, and others who are interested in this legislation to bring that about. Thank you very much.
Mr. Pecoraro, thank you. I want to say something. I've talked to at least one person that came in from an insurer regarding this kind of coverage, and one of my questions was, well, can't you just check, you know, when you're underwriting, doesn't that involve looking at a pilot's record, you know, whether or not they've had an accident before or whatever. Because if you're getting insurance for your automobile, I mean, they check on your tickets, et cetera, et cetera. And apparently there isn't that kind of a database. I think you have to really dig with the FAA or whatever to get that kind of information. Is your organization, and I'm not even sure it's an appropriate function of your organization, but have you looked into that kind of a database that might be helpful in, as you know, in these situations for the insurers? I mean, I know you're not an insurance company, but
we have not, Madam Chair. And while we represent 2/3 of the pilots in America, not all of them are members, and so we don't track all of these things. But in my the brief conversations I've had in the last couple of days with some folks from insurance agencies, they have said that it is very difficult for them to track these things, and that they have tended to rely on statements by folks who are seeking insurance. And I know that others have suggested that this kind of a database is certainly possible to build and access, and again, that's not an area of expertise that I have, but I think it's something that the committee might want to consider before enacting legislation.
OK. to appreciate that you came here.
Thank you very much.
To sunny Minnesota. Senator Pretner Solon.
Madam Chair, I'd like to disclose as a person who is heavily invested in the small aircraft business, I have no desire to see the aircraft industry upset by this type by any type of legislation. At the same time, I like to hold our pilots accountable for it, and responsible for the their conduct in the planes and for their preparation for being able to fly. And I can appreciate the fact that the insurance industry has concerns about having to incur greater expense. But I also feel that there is an urgency for us to protect the third party who has no knowledge that there may be fraud or there may be something out of order for which, though they have check to see if a pilot is insured. In fact, the industry then decides after an accident that they are not insured.
Okay, Senator Pretner Solon, are there any other questions? We're under some pressure here. The light's reflecting in the clock. I can't see. Let's see, but I think we've got a minute. Yeah. Are there other questions? Is there somebody else who wanted to testify? I'm sorry, sir. We'll listen really fast. Introduce yourself, please.
Madam Chairman, my name is Michael Lindberg. I'm a lawyer from the Twin Cities here, and I represent aviation insurers as a large part of my practice. And I counted 11 aviation insurers in the market. The earlier witness mentioned 12, and I have represented over the years about 9 of them. And I am here to give my perspective on this proposed legislation and to say that lines 116 and 117 are just jaw-droppingly radical, and there is nothing like them anywhere in the country.
As it pertains to aviation.
As it pertains to aviation or generally to liability insurance in general. Keep in mind that liability insurance is not a benefit to an injured person. It doesn't exist to pay medical bills. Rather, it exists to indemnify the policyholder, in this case, an airplane owner or pilot, if he or she is legally liable to reimburse an injured person for money damages. And one of those items of money damage can be medical bills, as Mr. Pearson mentioned earlier. But a liability insurance is not invoked by the mere happening of an accident. Liability insurance is invoked when somebody who is injured sues somebody who is at fault. Now, a factor that weighs large here is the fact that aviation insurance is handcrafted, and by that I mean if you go to an aviation insurer and seek to buy aviation insurance, it's very dissimilar to buying auto insurance from State Farm. The aviation insurer handcrafts the coverage based upon the number of hours you have as pilot in command, the types of hours, whether they're instrument hours, whether they're night hours, and whether they're commercial hours or private hours. And the insurance industry also focuses heavily upon whether those hours match the airplane for which you're seeking coverage. If there's any question, you cannot buy aviation insurance unless you go to school. You have to go obtain additional training. You have to sometimes go to schools for instrument training in distant parts of the country. And only then do you qualify for this insurance. And as I think all of the members of the committee can see, that back and forth process is a great a guarantee of safety, so that only qualified pilots are flying airplanes. For that reason, aviation insurance policies include requirements that only qualified pilots fly the airplane. And let me give you an example. If a pilot applies for coverage and says that he has a multi-engine rating, so he can fly complex aircraft with two engines, but in fact he's a student pilot with only 25 hours in his logbook, under this bill, the aviation insurance industry would be required to cover that pilot even though he's not a safe pilot, even though he's not a qualified pilot, and even though he lied through his teeth to get the policy. And, you know, the list of hypothetical situations can go on. You have pilots who dummy up logbooks and claim they've got 5,000 hours as pilot in command. In fact, they've got 50 hours. What's happening then through the operation of lines 116 and 117 is Minnesota would be unique in all the country in having aviation insurance policies with essentially no limits and no conditions and no exclusions. The dialogue earlier today has been focused on fraud by the applicant, and that's what Mr. Pearson's case involved, an applicant for insurance who misrepresented his piloting experience and what had happened to him in the past. But what's significant about the statute as proposed is that it goes on to say no violation of the policy shall defeat or avoid the policy. What this legislature would be doing then would be to stripping the policies from all of their terms, and it would be essentially like a performance bond. And that opens the floodgates to coverage for things that the insurance industry and the individual insurance underwriter never contemplated covering, such as a stolen airplane.
Mr. Lindberg, in your experience, would a pilot be able to get insurance if they had had an accident and then subsequently wanted to purchase insurance and continue to fly?
As I indicated, Madam Chair, the policies are handcrafted. An underwriter would make a decision as to how much of an additional premium that accident would invoke, or whether it was such a display of terrible piloting that they wouldn't insure the guy. And so it's that discretion, that judgment by an insurance underwriter would be stripped under this statute.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Lindberg, I guess I would take issue with what you said about the fact that this language is somehow so egregious that it isn't reflected anywhere else in statute. I think we have very similar language in statute in Minnesota with respect to automobile insurance liability. And the purpose is to protect innocent victims. You gave one example of where there could be a huge disparity between the pilot's training and whether they were a student pilot license and whether they had gone through the certification. And it seems to me that the insurance industry is in a position to be able to make that determination before they decide to issue the policy. But the way the existing law is, you can come back and say, well, gee, they said they had 400 hours of training and they really only had 390 hours of training, and you can choose to void the policy, and some innocent third party is going to be victimized in terms of losing coverage for something when they thought coverage exists. So it seems to me that you're in the position, or your clients are in the position, of doing due diligence before they accept the insurance policy premiums to do that kind of investigation, and that public policy should not allow the insurance companies to be in the position of negating these policies after the fact with respect to innocent victims.
Madam Chair and
yes,
Senator
Mr.
Olson,
Lindberg.
If I may respond, let me hold off on the analogy to auto insurance and get to that second. But with regard to the idea of due diligence, I respectfully suggest that This is an area where underwriters have to trust their applicants. And the best example of that is the institution of the pilot log. A pilot keeps a log book, and he or she is supposed to sign every page and add up all the hours that he's flown the airplane. There is no way to detect a forged log book. And I've seen it. I saw it on the Wellstone accident. Pilots love to give themselves more hours than they've actually flown, and there is literally no way to sniff out and ferret out a forged logbook. So it is not the case that you can go to some central database and find out if an applicant is misrepresenting his qualifications. Secondly, I think this committee would be well served to think about the analogy to auto insurance, because it is true that the Minnesota No-Fault Automobile Insurance Act contains language substantially similar to the language before this committee today that says no fraud or violation of the policy defeats or voids the policy. However, that's been interpreted by the Minnesota Supreme Court as having it, that language is as having its true function with regard to the first party benefits of no fault, in which the insurer pays its policyholder wage loss and medical benefits, as opposed to liability insurance, where the insurer pays for the legal obligation of its policyholder to pay off a judgment that's been taken, brought by a so-called innocent victim. There's a very good example of this. There's a case called State Farm against Lobeck from 1988 in which the Minnesota Supreme Court dealt with a situation where a young boy became a paraplegic, truly an innocent victim, after a couple of teenagers took off in a car that had belonged to the parents of another teenager. They didn't have permission. The holding of the case was that notwithstanding the no violation of the policy shall defeat or avoid the policy, that even though the No-Fault Act gave some appearance of imposing insurance coverage for this innocent victim, he didn't get any insurance because there was no coverage, and there was no coverage because the Supreme Court held that there was nothing wrong with insurers using reasonable exclusions in their policy. And the analogy then to automobile insurance, I think, is only to the extent that our no-fault system provides first-party benefits. And it is true that after an accident, nothing that the insured says or does can deprive the people in his car who are entitled to medical and wage benefits under the No-Fault Act from getting those benefits. So another point is this.
Hey, Mr. Lindbergh, I need you to, like,
wrap it up
really fast.
All right. The No-Fault Act features a benefit and a burden to the insurance industry. The insurance company its load is lightened in the sense it doesn't have to pay the medical bills to plaintiffs who have already received their medical bills paid by their own auto insurer. There's no corresponding benefit. There's no no-fault system in the aviation world. And that's why I think the analogy breaks down. In conclusion, I want to reiterate that this is path-breaking legislation. It has no correlate anywhere in the country. It nullifies all kinds of existing Minnesota statutes regarding aviation insurance and regarding insurance fraud. That's been unspoken here today. It's unaddressed, but I could name several statutes that are just out the window thanks to lines 116 and 117. This is radical stuff. It changes the way the world works in aviation, and I urge this committee to reject the lines 116 and 117.
Senator Prettner-Solin, your preference here.
Madam Chair, do you know where this goes next?
Chair?
I don't know.
They've asked. Judiciary Committee has asked for it.
Yeah,
and
I think it has to go there.
And that aspect would be handled in the Judiciary Committee. I mean, that piece, I mean, we certainly can act on it. We did. We adopted your amendment. The Judiciary Committee will be looking at lines 116 and 117. I think that's precisely what they'll be looking at.
And, Madam Chair, that I have been passed some potential language that we'd be willing to consider, but I'm in the same situation as the previous bill that was heard, where I haven't had a chance to look at the ramifications. It may be acceptable, but we'd like to continue to talk about
it. Well, and it's concerning this aspect of it, and I think that
line
is appropriate.
16 and 17.
And those lines will certainly be looked at by the Judiciary Committee.
and Senator Olson and I serve on that, so we know the discussion we've had here.
Madam Chair, just to add to the discussion, I also still have a problem with the limits. I think they've gone too far, even with the amendment. So I don't know where you want to go with all that.
Well, no, that's you're entitled to that. Did you hear the testimony about that they're writing policies for more than that? But Senator Prentice-Olin.
And Madam Chair, just a reminder that this was agreed on with the industry. These limits were acceptable.
So Senator Vandeveer, and then.
Chair, I don't know what that impact would be, though, on small. I don't know if we know what that impact will be on smaller.
The gentleman suggested
pilots.
$200
$200.
$200.
That's a $200 increase?
Yeah.
On a policy that costs how much?
Senator Prentice-Olin.
May I comment on that, Madam
yes.
Chair?
Yes, Mr. Lindbergh.
I'm no insurance underwriter, but keep in mind that the $200 would buy you an increase in limits from $25.50 to $100-$300. All that goes out the window if lines 116 and 117 are enacted. I mean, then the order of magnitude of exposure to the insurer goes up dramatically.
So
Madam Chair, I would move to delete lines 16 and 17.
On Senator Vandeveer's amendment motion to amend by deleting lines 116 and 117.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Prentice-Olin.
Madam Chair, I'd like to speak against that amendment. That language comes directly out of the Commerce Department provisions and the procedures, and it is what we're getting at.
And Senator Prentice-Olin, when you say it comes out of the department, are you referring to the auto?
I'm going to let Mr. Pearson.
Madam Chair, Senator, that the Commerce Department puts out an aviation insurance private and commercial little booklet, and within that booklet, they refer to, and I can supply the committee a copy of this if you want, but under policy conditions, they have explicitly any avoidance for fraud provision must make an exception so as not to apply to liability coverage. That's the heart of what we're getting at, is that we're putting that Commerce Department procedure that they publish into statute.
Mr. Pearson, that's the Minnesota Department of Commerce?
Madam Chair, yes.
We needed to hear that before. Senator Vandeveer.
Madam Chair, do we know what they're specifically referring to?
Anyone from the department here?
Well, they're speaking of liability coverage, which is what this line, this 116 and 117, do, because it all pertains to the liability toward a third party.
Madam Chair, is that for commercial or is that for small?
Is it for regular regular pilots, just recreational and?
Madam Chair, Senator, it's for all aircraft coverages, and then it specifically identifies Minnesota Statute 360.59, Subdivision 10. So I don't know if Senate Council has that there, and they could refer to that, but that's any avoidance for fraud provision must make an exception so as not to apply to liability coverage. That's where we got it from.
You know,
Madam Chair, may I respond?
Yes, Mr. Lindbergh.
I'd like to draw the committee's attention to the fact that the language that appears on lines 116 and 117 is not the same as and is significantly different from the language that appears in the document that Mr. Pearson just referred to. And let me explain what
Well, you know what, Mr. Lindbergh, I think we're under pressure. Another committee is due in here three minutes ago. Senator Prentice-Olin, I think we need to lay the bill over.
Madam Chair, I would accept that. I would like to make our deadlines, but if we
yes.
could
or
bring this up on the 15th.
Senator Vandeveer?
Maybe the 13th, I think it may.
The 13th.
I think that we could probably do that next. Is that Tuesday then?
Senator Madam Chair?
Yes.
I would withdraw my motion.
Okay.
Senator Vandeveer, if he is withdrawing his motion,
We will deal with this eventually in judiciary anyway, and if you're suggesting this conversation belongs there, is that what
well,
you...
Well, I think maybe this we, now we're back to Commerce Department. I'd like I'd like this committee to hear that.
Okay.
And we would do that as soon as our next meeting, which is Tuesday, Senator Pratt. So I gave Senator Torres Ray a little longer because they have a little more to work out, but I think that... We can look at this, and that's intriguing. And I hadn't heard that; I hadn't known that. So we're going to come, but we're going to lay the bill over until the 13th. But we will be meeting on the 13th, and we do have four or five bills that I want to tell members. Senator Sparks, Senator Higgins has a bill 816. I have a bill having to do with credit counseling and debt. That's Senate File 1532. And Senator Berglund, service charges on cashing certain checks, Senate File 847. And with that, members, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.